Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How familiar are the most famous voices of 20th century literature? While you might be intimately familiar with how Noel Coward and Gertrude Stein and Eudora Welty expressed themselves in print, hearing the way they communicated verbally can add an entirely new dimension to the way we understand our favorite authors. That's the idea behind two new collections of BBC interviews with 20th century literary giants made available on CD now by the British Library. Richard Fairman is the editor of The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers, and he joins us now to talk about these audio treasure troves. Richard, welcome to Think.
Hello to you from the British Library in England.
What do we learn about these writers by hearing them speak that is not necessarily apparent even when they are writing about their own work?
I think the thing that is really fascinating is that when we read their books, their fiction, or we see their plays, because we have playwrights on these discs as well, is that they're always expressing themselves through characters, whereas here in these recordings, they're mostly heard in interviews, and they're just being themselves.
And most of them are characters, though, as we assume.
There are some very vivid characters amongst them. Yes, think of Henry Miller, my goodness.
What did it take to get all of these collected in one place? Were they all sort of easily accessible in the archives, or did you really have to go digging?
It took 18 months altogether. The majority of the recordings are taken from BBC radio broadcasts, which were heard here in Britain from the period 1935 through to around 1980. But of course, you won't have heard them over there. And I think one of the really fascinating things is to see how American people respond hearing recordings of some of the most famous Americans that have never been heard before in the United States.
Yeah, you have some of the only known recordings, for example, of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
We do. That one actually came from the United States, from Princeton University. But the majority, even of the American writers' recordings, came from over here. People like Vladimir Nabokov, Isaac Bashevis Singer, James Michener, Eudora Welty, who you mentioned, Tennessee Williams. Those were all British broadcasts when they came over here and made interviews for the British public.
Well, let's start with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, of course, who's the man who gave us Sherlock Holmes. This is the only known recording of his voice. Is that correct?
It is. There is a short film of him in which he says much the same as he says here. But he talks briefly about the character of Sherlock Holmes and also his enthusiasm for spiritualism in each of them. So the content is almost identical.
There are two questions which my friends continually ask me. One is how I came to write Sherlock Holmes, and the other is why I became a spiritualist and about spiritualism generally. With regard to Sherlock Holmes, I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought, especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh, who had most remarkable powers of observation. He prided himself that when he looked at a patient, he could tell not only their disease, but very often their occupation and place of residence. Reading some detective stories, I was struck by the fact that their results were obtained in nearly every case by chance. I accept, of course, Edgar Allan Poe's splendid stories, which, though only three in number, are a model for all time. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes.
And I confess that is a recording of Arthur Conan Doyle from 1930, and he died very soon after that was made. Is that correct?
He did, and there's a wonderful story there, because the week after he died, 5,000 people attended a séance at the Royal Albert Hall here in London, and a medium claimed to have made contact with him on the other side.
Richard Fairman is my guest. We're talking about the two collections that he edited, The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers. Let's go next, Richard, to this wonderful interview with E.M. Forster, who, of course, gave us Howard's End and A Room with a View and A Passage to India. And apparently he was quite willing to discuss his work on the radio.
Some people made more radio broadcasts than others. Forster made something like 20 broadcasts, if not more, for the BBC. It's important to remember that he continued to live long after he wrote his last book, and so he needed something to do.
Let's listen to him.
If we are to answer the challenge of our time successfully, we must manage to combine the new economy and the old morality. The doctrine of laissez-faire will not work in the material world. It's led to the black market and the capitalist jungle. We must have planning and ration books and controls, or millions of people, they'll have nowhere to live and nothing to eat. On the other hand, the doctrine of laissez-faire is the only one that seems to work in the world of the spirit. If you plan and control men's minds, you stunt them. You get the censorship, the secret police, the road to serfdom, the community of slaves. Our economic planners sometimes laugh at us when we are afraid of totalitarian tyranny resulting from their efforts. Or rather, they sneer at us. For there is some deep connection between planning and sneering, which psychologists should explore. But the danger they brush aside is a very real one, and Mr. Koestler was quite right to point it out. We are assured that the new economy will evolve.
We heard there the voice of E.M. Forster, and that recording was made in 1946.
And how up-to-date it sounds. Do you think he was thinking about bankers when he was talking about laissez-faire economics?
I think perhaps he was able to communicate with the future. Yes, it's very interesting, and I guess we're still struggling with the same questions today, which points out even why all this literature remains relevant to us.
It does. I mean, even economics comes up because we have John Steinbeck talking about why he wrote The Grapes of Wrath. Maybe you're going to play a bit of that later. When you hear these writers engaging with the problems of their times, you realize just how vivid and alive it still is now.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to that clip of John Steinbeck.
We brought our Voice of America microphones today to the living room of the home of John Steinbeck here in Manhattan. And Mr. Steinbeck, we'd like to talk to you a little bit about probably your most famous book, certainly your first famous book, The Grapes of Wrath. We want to find out a little bit about the comparison of some of the things that you talk about to such great effect in The Grapes of Wrath, then, at that time, in 1937, and now in 1952. But first of all, I'd like to start off with a little background material on the book itself. Just how did you come to write The Grapes of Wrath, Mr. Steinbeck?
It was rather an accidental thing. I was living in my ranch in Los Gatos in California, and one of my very good friends was the city editor of the San Francisco News. He was not only editor, but editorial writer. He called me one day and told me that a number of people were starving to death in the San Joaquin Valley and asked me if I would go over and cover the story for the San Francisco News. I did, and I found that there were about 3,000 people completely cut off from the world by floods and completely cut off from contact with people by poverty, living in tents, huddled up on beds, and literally starving. I was so moved by this that I followed the people and the places they'd come from, and did a series of, I think, 6 or 7 articles for the San Francisco News. Those articles were then reprinted in pamphlet form, and very soon afterward, Life magazine asked me to go again and with one of their photographers and to do a more complete pictorial story of the situation of starving people in inadequately covered and inadequately fed. I did that for Life magazine, and they decided for one reason or another not to print it at that time.
A little bit of history there. We just heard the voice of John Steinbeck talking about why he chose to write The Grapes of Wrath, and of course that book started for him as a journalism project.
It did, and I think one of the things that really comes across with the American writers is how they were driven by a sense of social justice to become authors. And you hear that with John Steinbeck, and you hear it with many of the others as well.
Let's go next to this little clip from an incredibly charming person, it seems, P.G. Wodehouse, who is, we'll hear him interviewed here by Alastair Cook.
Mr. Wodehouse, how many books in all have you written? I always try to make it one a year, and I'm 82 now, so I suppose it must be 82.
Now, there's a question that a lot of people have asked me, and I don't know the answer, whether there ever was a particular man, a living human being, that gave you the idea of Bertie Wooster.
I wouldn't say any definite individual, but that type was very prevalent in the days when I was in and about London, you know, in 1911, 12, and 13.
Before the First War?
Yes. Late Anthony Mildmay, you know, Lord Mildmay, the steeplechaser, he was very much the type of Bertie Wooster.
Do you find that since the Second War he's become an historical character? He does.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know whether it's legitimate to go on writing about him.
But I think you once mentioned that the strangest countries now are catching
up. Oh, yes. Occasionally get a Jeeves from Japan or Yugoslavia or somewhere like that. They're very popular in India, in the Penguin edition. I keep getting a lot of letters from India.
Well, do they see these books for what they are? I mean, or do they take them very seriously as social documents?
Oh, I shouldn't think that's possible, is it? I think they must read them just as farces. I don't suppose they think they're sort of satirical stuff.
Do the communist countries buy them?
They've started again now. I was banned in Hungary. Do you remember a few years ago, a great number of English authors were banned in Hungary? I was one of them. I suppose they thought my stuff was too little about the proletariat and too much about the earls and dukes and
but
so
on. But couldn't
they,
couldn't, for instance, a communist country pretend to the readers that this was an accurate or a devastating picture of the decadence of the upper classes?
Yes, I suppose they could, yes.
Well, now, how about the translations? This must be a tremendous feat.
Yes, I think they miss an awful lot, you know. Osborne wrote a thing in Punch some years ago about my stuff translated into French, and he showed how they, whenever they came to a difficult bit, they rather apt to dodge it. You know, they'd put down something that much straighter than what I'd written.
Well,
because
now,
they couldn't get the slang, I suppose.
Of the elements of your own comic style, it strikes me more and more in reading the latest book that probably you're the only man who's ever combined this very formal and polished 19th century style with contemporary English slang, with American contemporary slang. Now, you must have been aware of that all through your life.
I suppose so, yes.
Because you came here very young, didn't you?
Yes, I was about 23, I think, when I first came here.
That was a clip that we have heard from P.G. Woodhouse, interviewed by Alastair Cook as part of the British Library's new collection of recordings, The Spoken Word. This is from The Spoken Word British Writers. Editor Richard Fairman is here. Richard, listening to that, I get the sense that nothing delighted P.G. Woodhouse more than to be banned in Hungary.
I think it's amazing. His books are so charming and harmless.
And he goes on to talk all about sort of the understanding of the butler culture and the way the world has really changed. It's really a great piece.
It is. It's very entertaining. And one thing that's nice about the recordings from around 1950 to 60 onwards is that they're that bit longer and you really get to know the speakers a bit.
Richard Fairman is with us. He is the editor of The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers. We will have more of both coming up. We'll hear from Henry Miller, Vladimir Nabokov, Virginia Woolf, the only known recording of her voice. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Fairman. He is editor of the British Library's collections of writing of recorded interviews by British and American writers of the 20th century, the spoken word British writers and the spoken word American writers. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's listen in a moment, Richard. We're going to hear F. Scott Fitzgerald, but he's not actually talking about his own work or even reading his own work. He is reciting from Shakespeare.
That's correct. F. Scott Fitzgerald didn't make any broadcasts that survived. There are just three very short recordings of him reading other people's literature. And I chose the extract that he reads from Shakespeare's Othello because I think he reads it beautifully.
Most potent, grave, and reverend singers, my very noble and approved good masters, that I have ta'en away this old man's daughter, 'tis most true. True, I have married her. The very head and front of my offending hath this extent, no more. Rude am I in my speech and little versed in the set phrase of peace, for since these arms of mine had 7 years' pith, they have used their dearest action in the tented field, and little of the great world can I bespeak, save as pertains to feats of broil and battle. Therefore, little will I grace my cause in speaking for myself. Yet, by your gracious patience, I will a round, unvarnished tale deliver of my whole course of love. What drugs, what charms, what conjurations, and what mighty magic, for such proceedings I am charged withal, I won his daughter with.
That was F. Scott Fitzgerald, the only known recording of his voice. I'm here with Richard Fairman, who edited this collection. And people may notice that there are some gaps in the text, some major pauses. You think it's possible he was reciting from memory and forgot a couple things?
He definitely was. He goes on to read a part of a poem by Keats, and he gets quite lost in that and gives up. But remember, these were recordings he was just making for himself, as far as we know.
Mm-hmm. You also have what appears to be the only known recording of the voice of Virginia Woolf. Was she simply media shy, or were these things lost ultimately?
They were lost. Mm-hmm. Virginia Woolf made 3 broadcasts for the BBC on the radio in the 1930s. At that time, people didn't keep radio broadcasts. They went out live on the air, and that was it. They were lost. But some very foresighted person at the BBC decided to keep just 8 minutes of one of the broadcasts, and we are very proud and pleased to be able to put that out in its complete form on a CD for the first time.
It is them we hear. It is them we see. Only after the writer is dead do his words to some extent, only to some extent, become disinfected, purified of the accidents of the living body. Now, this power of suggestion is one of the most exciting and most mysterious properties of words. Most exciting if you are a person in the habit of using them. Everyone who has ever written a sentence must be conscious or half conscious of it. Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing them today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past. The splendid word incarnadine, for example, who can use that without remembering multitudinous seas? In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word.
That was the only known recording of Virginia Woolf, and of course it goes on in the collection, The Spoken Word British Writers, but we're just listening to a little bit today. I don't know what I thought Virginia Woolf would sound like, Richard, but I somehow didn't think she would sound like that.
That's the big question, isn't it? Some people who knew her many years later when they heard this recording said that they felt she didn't sound like that. But others say that's exactly how we always thought she must have sounded. One thing is certain, she doesn't sound like Nicole Kidman in that film that was made of Virginia Woolf.
Certainly not, yeah. Now, this was 1937 that we just heard that recording from, and the quality is actually quite good. We hear some scratches. I'm wondering how much technical magic that took to get all of these ready to be released on CD.
By and large, the quality is not bad, I think. If you think, as you say, that's from, you know, coming up to, well, it's over 70 years ago now, it really has survived very well. I just allowed myself to include one or two where the quality wasn't so good because I thought the content was so interesting. For example, the very first recording on the American writers is Gertrude Stein, and that was very, very poor quality. But it is such a fantastic recording, and it just brings it to life so well. I thought, let's have that one in, so that's included.
It's funny, I struggled with that one too, and then finally decided not to use it on our broadcast, but people can get this collection, and then hopefully they'll be able to listen to it there. And you've actually included a transcript.
We did, because when I listened to it, I felt that you couldn't always pick up what she was saying, and so I spent quite a long while really listening to it carefully, making a transcript, and we printed that in the booklet so that people can hear and distinguish much more clearly what she's saying.
Richard Fairman is my guest. He worked with the British Library to edit the spoken word British writers and the spoken word American writers, two new CD collections of recordings of some of the greatest English language writers of the 20th century. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've wanted this for years. What a thrill to be able to ask somebody this question. How is the rise of technology, of audio technology, affected the history of writing itself? Because vernacular speech has just taken over all of our fiction, whether it's television, movies, and novels. And I was wondering if your guest ever has sensed that the gap between the way authors talked and the way that they wrote has gotten larger or smaller, and just talk generally about how audio has affected writing. Thank you.
Great question. Thanks.
It is. Goodness, so many ideas come into my mind. I don't know where to start. Well, we just heard Virginia Woolf, for example, and I think you probably will have heard how stuffy she sounds. That's how she felt she wanted to talk on the radio. But I don't think many writers would talk in such a stuffy way now. And yet we have two of the American writers who speak off the cuff for these radio broadcasts in the most extraordinary way, almost as if they were writing a book. One is Gertrude Stein, which we just talked about, and the other one is Vladimir Nabokov. And you can't really believe that ordinary people ever spoke like that.
And Nabokov seems to be really a guy who is wrapped up in the pedantic irritations of writing more than anything else.
Is he really, or is he pretending? I don't know. He's giving a great performance, whichever it is.
Well, let's hear it.
Is writing your novels a pleasure or a drudgery?
Pleasure and agony while composing the book in my mind. Harrowing irritation when struggling with my tools and viscera, the pencil that needs resharpening, the card that has to be rewritten, the bladder that has to be drained, the word that I always misspell and always have to look up. Then the labor of reading the typescript prepared by a secretary, the correction of my major mistakes and her minor ones, transferring corrections to other copies, misplacing pages, trying to remember something that had to be crossed out or inserted, repeating the process when proofreading, unpacking the radiant, beautiful, plump advance copy, opening it and discovering a stupid oversight committed by me, allowed by me to survive. After a month or so, I get used to the book's final stage, to its having been weaned from my brain. I now regard it with a kind of amused tenderness, as a man regards not his son, but rather the young wife of his son.
Does the aristocrat in you despise the fictionist?
Pushkin, professional poet and Russian nobleman, he used to shock the beau monde by declaring that he wrote for his own pleasure, but published for the sake of money. I do likewise, but have never shocked anybody, except perhaps a former publisher of mine who used to counter my indignant requests by saying that I am much too good a writer to need extravagant advances.
That is a Vladimir Nabokov, a recording from 1970, which is part of the Spoken Word American Writers Collection. Editor Richard Fairman is here. I can't decide if I would love to sit down and have a drink with this guy or if I would run screaming from the room.
Isn't he bizarre? He talks like a book, doesn't
yeah.
he?
He even the way he sort of sets everything off in apposition and then continues as if he's writing an essay.
Yes, I mean, in answer to the gentleman who phoned in, would he speak like that if he was alive today? And if he was making a lot of radio broadcasts, maybe he would change as a writer and he would write in a different way.
Yeah, it's funny, though, 1970 was not that long ago. And it seems
wasn't.
He was a holdover maybe from another time.
Quite near the end of his life. He was born just at the end of the 19th century, so maybe he stretches back to another era.
On the other hand, you hear some people that are obviously very comfortable with the spoken word, but there's a wonderful little exchange that Noel Coward has with a reporter in, of all places, the airport.
Mr. Coward, your novel Pomp and Circumstance has just been published. How did the writing of it compare with playwriting?
Well, I enjoyed writing it, but of course it's about 10 times longer than writing a play, so therefore it took much longer to do. But I enjoyed it. It's a very cheerful book, I hope.
Your earlier music, such as Bittersweet, has a tremendously nostalgic quality about it. When you were much younger, did you feel nostalgia?
No, not particularly, but as the subject was nostalgic, the music was nostalgic. I think that the subject dictates the mood of the music.
Do you have any particular favorite among modern playwrights?
Yes, Terence Rattigan. And Noel Coward.
What do you think of the ex-angry young men?
I think of them very little, as a matter of fact.
And do you think critics today are inclined to be a little intoxicated with their own cleverness more than previous critics?
I've not observed any particular cleverness in the critics of today, nor any particular signs of intoxication. But I think they're, on the whole, fairly earnest and almost completely ignorant of the theatre.
Is there any chance of your bringing off another exciting entertainment spectacle like your performance at Las Vegas?
I don't think so, not at the moment. I shall be doing a new movie early in the new year.
What will it be about?
That I can't say yet because it is not settled, but it's quite a good one, I hope.
The actors and actresses who've played in your plays have an extreme devotion to you, even today. Could you tell me which of them, or if this isn't an invidious question, you remember most clearly?
Of the actors and actresses who have played with me?
Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, but there are so many. I've always loved the casts I've worked with. I've had very good luck. Most of the people who were friends of mine many years ago still are, and I love my own people of the theatre.
Do you think Gertrude Lawrence was perhaps the greatest of them all?
Oh, Gertrude, I shall miss always till the end of my days. She was wonderful. We were children together, and we grew up together, and we acted a great deal together, and of course I miss her sadly.
Do you feel that modern plays incline too much towards education rather than entertainment?
I think certain modern plays incline too much to propaganda, and I think propaganda is death in the theatre. I think the theatre is primarily a place of entertainment, and if you've got a message, you've got to wrap it up with such skill that the audience enjoy the play without, and only think about the message later.
Do you think that Oscar Wilde's wit is dated or not?
The importance of being earnest will never be dated. It's a brilliant, one of the great comedies of the world.
Are there any more plays that we shall have to be able to look forward to in the near future?
I expect so, but having just done a new play and a novel and two films recently, I'm just taking a little time off to collect my thoughts and think which direction to spring in next.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Gard.
That was Noel Coward, as interviewed on by the BBC. And we should point out, Richard Fairman, that this was 6 a.m. And he was still on top of his game and really very witty. Most of us, I think, before coffee would have a hard time thinking of those lines.
Yes, and interestingly, the interviewer I made contact with through these CDs being issued. And he was able to give me all the details about how he went out to Heathrow Airport here in London to interview Noel Coward at 5 o'clock in the morning and caught Noel Coward off the plane from Jamaica at 6.
Was he nervous to go interview him, or was this the sort of thing he did all the time?
He made quite a few, but that was one of his real celebrity engagements.
There are a couple of people that you, the interviewers, that you had a hard time or were unable to identify before the series went to press. Have you subsequently found any of those people?
No, we haven't. Mm-hmm. Those are mostly the non-BBC recordings, because the BBC ledgers are mostly very accurate and full.
And I know that there are a few people that you wish you could have included in the series that you weren't able to find recordings of.
Oh, there are some very famous names whose voices should have survived and haven't. On this side of the Atlantic, it is just amazing that nobody ever recorded or kept the voice of George Orwell, the author of 1984 and Animal Farm. He actually worked at the BBC, where he made really many broadcasts, and not a single part of any one of them was ever kept. So that is a great loss. On your side of the Atlantic, as it were, Americans, it's quite possible that Mark Twain could have left a recording, but he didn't. Henry James certainly could have done, but he didn't. So there are some very famous people we'd love to have. If anybody has a recording of any of these, please let us know.
We will be back in just a minute to talk about all of these recordings that we have, and we will hear some more. Richard Fairman is my guest. He edited The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers, two different collections on CD being published by the British Library. We'll return to our discussion in a minute. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll hear two different versions of Ian Fleming, once talking about his own work and then interviewing a very drunk Raymond Chandler. That comes up in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The British Library has just made available two different CD sets of literary giants of the 20th century. One is called The Spoken Word British Writers. The other is called The Spoken Word American Writers. My guest this hour is Richard Fairman, who is the editor of both collections. And they include interviews, actually two of them, with Ian Fleming, best known to us as the man who created James Bond.
Mr. Fleming, where were you born?
I was born in London.
You went to Eton. I believe your main distinction there was in athletics.
Yes, it was. I'm afraid I wasn't terribly good at my books.
Victor Ludorum twice and public schools hurdles. And then Sandhurst?
Yes, I went to Sandhurst with the idea of going into the army and into the Black Watch, incidentally. But then it was decided to mechanize the army, and me and a lot of my friends decided we didn't want to be what we thought then would be large-scale garage mechanics.
So?
So I had a go at the diplomatic and learnt my languages for it, and I passed in seventh, but there were only five vacancies, and so I decided not to have another go, but to go straight in and start earning some money. So I joined Reuters, which was the nearest thing to the diplomatic in a way, because I could use my languages, German and French and Russian, and I had a wonderful time in Reuters. I was a correspondent in Moscow and Berlin and all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I learnt there the sort of good straightforward, or at any rate, straightforward writing style that everybody wants to have if they're going to write books.
How long did you stay with them?
I stayed with them for 3 years. But then
I wanted to earn some more money, and writers weren't very keen on paying large sums in those days. I no doubt they're much better now. And so I went into the city.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get on very well there because I'm not very good at making money as such.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, just pure making money. I must do something that entertains me. If it makes money in the same time, well, that's all the better for me.
Yes. Well, then the war came along and you joined the Royal Navy. You became personal assistant to the Director of Naval Intelligence. Well, this led, not surprisingly, to some rather violent action, I believe.
Well, not so much that, really. It was a very interesting life. I took part in the Dieppe raid, which was a very bloody affair, and I had some exciting adventures around the world, and altogether I had an extremely... I couldn't have had a more interesting war, if I can have an interesting war.
And presumably your naval...
That was the voice of Ian Fleming being interviewed, and it certainly is obvious when you listen to that, Richard, you see where the inspiration, at least, for a really brilliant spy might have come from.
You certainly do. All those world travels, you can just imagine those James Bond films with all the exotic locations in his mind already.
Now, perhaps you can also identify with this. The next clip we're about to hear is when Ian Fleming has been asked to interview Raymond Chandler, this great thriller writer, and is a very good sport about this because apparently Chandler had been drinking heavily before the interview began.
That's what the producer of the program has reminisced about in subsequent years, yes.
And it's pretty obvious when we listen to it.
Well, the first thing, I suppose, Ray, really, is to define what we're supposed to be talking about. And I think the title of what we're supposed to be talking about is English and American thrillers. The first thing is, what is a thriller? And in my mind, of course, you don't write thrillers, and I do.
I do, too.
I don't call yours a novel.
Well, other people call them thrillers.
I know, I think it's wrong.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you write novels of suspense like Simenon does and Eric Ambler does, perhaps, but in which violence is the background, just as love might be in the ordinary kind of straight
well,
novel.
Well, in America, a thriller or mystery story writer, as we call them, is slightly below the salt.
Well, the thriller writer, he is very below the salt, really.
You can write a very lousy, long, historical novel full of sex and can be a bestseller and can be treated respectfully.
Yes.
But a very good thriller writer who writes far, far better is just get the little paragraph, that's
yes,
all.
Yes, I know, it's probably true.
Mostly.
Yeah.
There's no attempt to judge him as a writer.
Well, I don't know, I suppose... But you yourself are judged as a writer, and Dashiell Hammett was,
oh,
I think.
Yes, but how long did it take me? You starved to death for 10 years before your publisher knows you're any good.
Well, yes, because your first story is now a very valuable first edition. Where do you get your material? I mean, nearly always a Californian setting, isn't it? Has it ever not been a Californian setting?
Well, I lived many years in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles had never been written about. California had been written about a book by called Ramona.
Mm.
A lot of sentimental slop. But nobody in my time had tried to write about the Los Angeles background in any sort of realistic way.
No.
Of course, now half the writers in America live in California.
Because Nathaniel West... did, I think, didn't he? At least,
Yeah, but he came along much, much later.
Yes, he did. That's quite true.
That was Raymond Chandler being interviewed by Ian Fleming. And again, Fleming comes across as a very good sport, trying valiantly to sort of keep Chandler on the subject, as it were.
Yes. In Chandler's defense, I think we also should say that he had a bad cold at the time, so he was a good sport in going ahead with it.
Well, and it is, you know, you still get a sense of who he is and maybe a more honest sense of exactly what he felt about his work and the way it was received.
Indeed, because they were two old friends, and it's like having them sit down by the fireside with a couple of bottles of something or other and reminiscing. And interestingly, this was the last time they met, because Chandler died very soon afterwards. It's the only recording that we know of Chandler's voice at all. And it's one of only two radio broadcasts of Ian Fleming. You've just played a clip of the other one, which is known to survive as well. So in its way, it's quite a rarity.
And we hear off the top Chandler sort of lamenting the fact that you could write a novel that was full of sex and be very well respected. And the next interview we're going to hear is with Henry Miller, who talks about exactly that subject.
Richard Stanley first asked him, did he think that people read his books like Tropic of Cancer for the wrong reasons, for the erotic content rather than for the literary ability?
Oh, absolutely. I have no hesitation in admitting that. Oh, absolutely. Even today, I think. Fortunately, there is another group who grew up side by side with those wrong readers, so to speak. And those were the esoteric ones, the mystical ones. So they talk of me as being a mystic, which I don't want to hear. I'm not a mystic. But I'm interested in many other things than sex, naturally. Yeah. It would be a pity if that was all, you know.
You seem at once to disown sex as a trivial matter and at the same time use it as a sharp edge for reality. Is this something you've always felt?
It wasn't either way. Sex, to me, is a vital part of life. Without it, there'd be no life. Naturally, that's a bad cliche. But what I was against is the overindulgence, the overimportance given. Today, by the way, sex has no pull anymore. Everybody is immersed in it like in a hot bath. Do you know what I mean? Therefore, there's no ecstasy, no surprise, no enjoyment, as you might say. It's as though they were doing exercises. Do you see what... Sure. Do you see what... Whereas when you had to struggle to get a little piece of tail, as we call it, you know, that was worthwhile. It was like looking for a meal when you're hungry, don't you see? Now they're no longer...
That was Henry Miller reflecting on the sexual content of his work. Again, another guy who clearly had a great sense of humor about what he was doing.
Yeah, oh, isn't he great? He's one of my favorites. As we were saying earlier, you get to know these people. And by the time you finish that interview, it's as though he's one of your best friends.
Yeah, you have a sense that if you were the one to sit with him, you would feel that way as well.
Exactly. And I've decided that Eudora Welty must be the nicest person in the world after listening to a number of her interviews. And that's the great thing. It's almost like, as somebody said, going to a cocktail party where all the greatest writers of the 20th century were there, and you do the room, getting to know them one by one.
That's exactly what it feels like. Let's listen now to perhaps the nicest person in 20th century literature.
When the Southern Review began to publish my stories from Baton Rouge, Louisiana State University Press, that was Robert Penn Warren, Clint Brooks, and so on. Catherine Ann was down there, and when the stories appeared in the Southern Review, out of the clear sky, she wrote a letter to me and said she thought they were good stories and invited me to come down and see her. She was very good to young writers and encouraged them and read them. I've had the nicest things in my life have happened from letters out of the blue from writers. One came from E.M. Foster one time, and one came from B.S. Pritchett one time, just writing to say they had enjoyed something of mine. It's wonderful what writers do for one another, what some writers do.
That was Eudora Welty talking about how writers support one another, and it is wonderful that she mentions E.M. Forster, and then we had the chance to hear him earlier in the hour. And again, there's a sort of warmth that comes through that makes sense when you consider Eudora Welty's writing.
There is. If I could meet one of these writers in the flesh, I would choose to meet her.
I have to say that if I could choose a favorite voice of the whole thing, and it's amazing to hear all these regional dialects from the UK and from the United States. It's another interesting study for the project. But Tennessee Williams would have to be my very favorite.
What was the first play that was put on a proper scale?
Well, the first one that was put on very elaborately by the Theatre Guild in New York with the... a lady who was a very talented actress and at that time a great star, Miriam Hopkins.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And your Margaret Webster was the director. And there was great hopes for it, but...
And this was the play?
This was Battle of Angels, the play that from which Orpheus Descending
the
derived.
Ancestor of your new play, yes.
Yeah, the ancestor of it, exactly. But it met with disaster in Boston. I don't think any of us had anticipated the sort of sensorial reaction that we would get in Boston.
Were the critics right about it, do you feel, on reflection?
Well, they didn't note certain virtues that it had. I had a very good ear for Southern speech, and I could write scenes, you know, that were quite authentic in speech. And I could create characters that were very valid and moving. But I went overboard, you see. I was pretty hammy, you know. And in that early play particularly, it got way out of bounds, you know. There were too many things happening all at once. It was violent and a little disordered, you might say.
Is Orpheus Descending, your new play, is this the first time you've come back to this theme since then?
No, Orpheus Descending, you noted, is a descendant of that first play, but it's gone through many mutations. It's been called by various titles, and whenever I ran out of other material, I would go back to Battle of Angels and rewrite it some more and some more and some more. I think I rewrote it too much. It's the play that seems most personal to me, the one that I... in a way, have the most tenderness for, perhaps because it I associate it with my youth.
What did you go on to?
That was the voice of Tennessee Williams talking, among other things, about Orpheus Descending. It's remarkable how candid he is in that interview.
And he really is later as well, when he starts talking about how it has hurt him that he's had bad reviews on Broadway. He is extremely open, and also by the end, he's shown he's a man with a really big sense of humor.
Yeah, it's I guess common for writers to say they don't care a bit about the reviews or things like that, but he's willing to be out there with everything. What does this all make you think, having worked on this project, Richard, about the way that we ought to be preserving and recording even the 21st century's greatest writers?
We certainly should, and indeed here at the British Library we've started an oral history project in which writers give very long interviews, often up to 10 hours, talking about their life and work. I think one can never keep too much, especially with new technology. It isn't as though the recordings take up a lot of space if you want to keep them. There's no excuse anymore. And when we listen back and we think how we would love to hear more of Virginia Woolf or more of Raymond Chandler than there is, you know, those of us in the current generation working in libraries and archives and radio stations should do more.
Is there, in your mind, a most important question that you would want every oral history to contain?
Well, I would be tempted to say that you should ask the writer, why did you become a writer? But so many of them are asked that here, and they don't really have a good answer.
So I guess it all depends on what they'll actually tell you.
It is. You were talking about how Tennessee Williams opens up and talks about his bad reviews. So even more does Lillian Hellman, mm-hmm. and I find her interview very moving. To catch people, especially in later life, when they have perhaps regrets about what has happened, is a tremendous insight into them as people.
Richard Fairman is the editor of The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers, a fascinating collection of CD sets published by the British Library. Richard, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.